father's cabinet and ask them flattering questions about statecraft and finance. He wrote to military commanders to commend them on victories and to inquire about the strategies they'd deployed. He corresponded with gunsmiths and shipwrights and applied himself to learning languages, the one thing at which he did not particularly excel, so that he could address them in their own tongues. When Dominic's older brother was sent to the front, Nikolai used every bit of sway he had to get him reassigned to a place where the fighting was light. And by then he had considerable sway. He did it because he liked learning the puzzle of each person. He did it because it felt good to feel his influence and understanding grow. But above all else, he did it because he knew he needed to rescue his country. Nikolai had to save Ravka from his own family. As was tradition among noblemen, Vasily accepted his officer's commission and treated his military service as symbolic. Nikolai joined the infantry. He endured basic training with Dominic at Politsnaya, and they traveled together to their first assignment. Dominic was there when Nikolai took his first bullet, and Nikolai was there when Dominic fell at Holmhend, never to rise again. On that battlefield, heavy with black smoke and the acrid scent of gunpowder, Nikolai had shouted for a medic, a Grisha healer, anyone to help them. But no one came. He was not a king's son then, just one more voice crying out in the carnage. Dominic made Nikolai promise to take care of his family, to make sure his mother knew he died well. And then he said,
"Do you know the story of Andrei Zirov?"
The revolutionary? Zirov had been a radical in Nikolai's grandfather's time. A grin ghosted over Dominic's blood-flecked lips.
"When they tried to hang him for treason, the rope broke, and he rolled into the ditch the soldiers had dug for his grave."
Nikolai tried to smile. "I never heard that story." Dominic nodded.
"This country," Zirov shouted, "they can't even hang a man right."
Nikolai shook his head.
"Is that true?" "I don't know," said Dominic.
A wet sound came from his chest as he struggled to breathe.
"I just know they shot him anyway."
Soldiers did not cry. Princes did not weep. Nikolai knew this. But the tears fell anyway.
"Dominic the Brave, hold on a little longer."
Dominic squeezed Nikolai's hand.
"This country gets you in the end, brother. Don't forget it."
"Not us," he said.
But Dominic was already gone.
"I'll do better,"
Nikolai promised, just as he had so many years ago in Mitkin's classroom.
"I'll find a way."
He had witnessed 1,000 deaths since then. His nightmares had been plagued by countless other battlefields. And yet, it was that promise to Dominic that haunted his waking hours. But how was he to explain any of this to Zoya? Still sitting patiently at the corner of the bed, still keeping her distance. He looked up at the honeycomb ceiling, blew out a long breath.
"I think I can fix it," he said at last.
"I've always known Ravka is broken, and I've seen the way it breaks people in return. The wars never cease, the trouble never stops, but I can't help believing that somehow I'll find a way to outsmart all of the kings who came before and set this country right."
He shook his head and laughed.
"It is the height of arrogance."
"I'd expect no less of you," Zoya said, but her voice was not cruel.
"Why did you send Nina away?"
"What?"
The question took him by surprise. Even more, the rapid, breathless way Zoya had spoken the words, as if forcing them from her lips. She did not look at him.
"We almost lost her before. We barely had her back, and you sent her into danger again."
"She's a soldier," he said. "You made her one, Zoya.
Sitting idle in the palace with nothing but her grief to occupy her mind was no good for her. But she was safe. And all of that safety was killing her.
Nikolai watched Zoya carefully.
Can you forgive me for sending her away?
I don't know.
I won't ask you to forgive me for what happened in the bell tower.
You spoke,
she said slowly.
That night, in Balakirev, you said my name.
But, Nikolai sat up straighter. The beast had never had language before. Not when he'd been infected during the war, and as far as he knew, not now that the monster had returned. When the Darkling had infected him, even in the moments when Nikolai was able to push his awareness to the fore, he hadn't been able to read, hadn't been able to communicate. It was one of the most painful elements of his transformation. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe my consciousness was trying to find a way through. Today, she shook her head.
You didn't sound like you.
Well, in that form, you sounded like him. He paused. I'm tempted to say it was fear or your imagination getting the best of you. She glared at him. But I'd prefer not to get slapped.
I know it doesn't make sense. It might have been the fear or the fight. But I truly believed you wanted to kill me.
You weren't just hungry, you were eager.
Zoya clenched her fists against her thighs.
You liked frightening me.
He wanted to say that he wouldn't have hurt her, that he would have stopped the thing inside him before it could, but he refused to do either of them the dishonor of that lie.
Is it possible? He asked instead. Could the Darkling's consciousness have somehow survived with his power?
I hope not. She unclenched her fists.
I hope there's a thornwood waiting beneath the sands of the fold. I hope all of this talk of magic rituals and warrior priests turns out to be more than just a fanciful tale.
But if there is no cure, and if this thing in you is more than just a curse the Darkling left behind, if he's trying to use you to find a way back to this world.
She looked at him, her blue eyes fierce in the lamplight. He sensed the deep well of loss inside her, the pain she worked so hard to hide.
I will put a bullet in your brain before I let that happen, Nikolai.
The men who had ruled Ravka had loved power more than they'd ever loved their people.
It was a disease, Nikolai knew that, and he'd sworn he would not be that kind of leader, that he would not succumb. And yet he'd never been sure that when the time came, he could step aside and give up the throne, the thing he'd fought so long and hard for. And if he let himself become more monster than man, it would mean he had failed. So he would put aside his doubt and his desires. He would try to be better. And the woman before him would make sure he protected Ravka, even from himself.
He took her hand, pressed a kiss to her knuckles.
My ruthless Zoya. I'll load the gun myself.
Chapter 13. Nina. Nina and Hannah took turns dozing, shoulders pressed together, making a show of sleeping as their guards stood by. When both of them were in danger of giving in to exhaustion, they asked each other questions. Favorite sweet, favorite book, favorite pastime. Nina learned that Hannah loved cream buns filled with vanilla custard. Had a secret taste for the gruesome novels popular in Ketterdam, the gorier the better, though translations were hard to find. And that she was fond of sewing. Sewing, Nina had whispered incredulously, remembering the way Hannah had ridden into the clearing the previous night, rifle at the ready. I thought you liked hunting and brawling and, she wrinkled her nose, nature.
It's a useful skill,
Hannah said defensively.
Who darned your husband's socks?
I did, of course, Nina lied. Though soldiers were supposed to learn their way around a needle and thread, she'd never managed it. She'd always just gone with holes in her socks. But I didn't enjoy it. The well mother must approve. Hannah rested her head against the wall. Her hair had dried in thick, rosy brown waves. You'd think that, wouldn't you? But apparently needlework is for ladies and sewing should be left to the servants. So should knitting and baking.
You can bake? Said Nina. You have my attention.
In the morning, Nina beamed at the men crowded into the room and insisted they make sure to visit Lennart Bjord's house on their way through Overoot.
Why can't we escort you now?
Asked the bearded man.
We'd be delighted, of course, Nina said through gritted teeth.
To Nina's surprise, Hannah chimed in.
We didn't think you'd want to stop over with us to do our penance with the women of the well. But how wonderful. I understand the sisters there are happy to perform the skad on any male visitors for only a small fee.
Nina had read about the skad. Enduring it was a stamp of Fjärden manhood. But also, occasionally, a death sentence. It required a 3-month vow of celibacy and ritual purging with lye to cleanse the spirit. The bearded man blanched.
We'll take you to the outskirts of Gafala, but then we have duties, elsewhere.
Yes, added the man with the tufty brows.
Many duties.
Where exactly will we find Lennart Bjord's house?
Another asked as he followed them outside. A thick layer of snow had covered the ground, though Nina could already see some of it melting away with the rising sun. The hard wind had dwindled to a soft breeze. The brute must have tired himself out.
Just head to the main square in Overoot, Nina said. It's the grandest house on the boulevard.
Look for the one with the biggest gables, added Hannah. The prettiest in town.
Is that your horse? He said. Where's your side saddle?
It must have been lost in the snow, said Nina.
Glad Hannah rode bareback, and that they didn't have a man's saddle to explain.
We'll just walk him to Gafala.
When they were well out of the view of the lodge, they mounted Hannah's horse.
The skad?
Nina asked, resting her hands lightly at Hannah's lean waist as their thighs braced together. Hannah glanced over her shoulder and cast Nina a surprisingly wicked smile.
My religious education should be good for something.
They circled back toward camp. And now that the snow had stopped, they had no trouble spotting the yellow flag and Adric's tent. He waved to them, and Nina knew his relief that she had survived the storm was real, even as he made a great show of seeming incensed about Hannah's trousers.
I thought the Semini didn't care about such things, Hannah grumbled.
His wife is Zemini. He's Kalish, and he's concerned about why you were out on your own.
Actually, what were you doing out here yesterday?
Hannah tilted her face up to the sky, closing her eyes.
I needed to ride. When the weather is about to turn is the best time. The fields are empty then.
Won't you be in trouble for spending a night away from the convent?
I volunteered to fetch fresh water. The well mother will just be glad she didn't have to tell my father his daughter died of exposure in the middle of a storm.
And your friends? They didn't come with you? Hannah kept her gaze on the white horizon.
It's a game to them. A childish bit of dress-up. A chance to be daring. For me.
She shrugged. It was survival. There was something solitary in Hannah. Nina couldn't pretend to really understand it. She loved company, noise, the bustle of a crowded room. But for a girl like this, to be forever trapped in the convent, watching the sisters and constantly forced to perform pious Fjärden womanhood? It was a dismal thought. Even so, Hannah's presence at the convent meant she might be a source of information about the factory. Though she was only a novitiate, she had to hear about the spring maiden's visits up the mountain.
Ride with us a little longer,
Nina said to Hannah as she mounted her own horse. Hannah looked like she wanted to bolt, but Nina knew the other girl didn't want to risk offense when she was still desperate to ensure Nina's silence.
Come on,
Nina urged gently.
I won't keep you long.
They set a moderate pace, Adric trailing them with a sledge. How old are you anyway? Nina asked. Hannah's jaw set, her profile sharp against the silvery sky.
19. And yes, that's old for a novitiate.
So Nina was right. They were almost the same age.
You aren't ready to take vows.
Hannah gave a curt shake of her head.
But you can't go home.
Another shake of the head.
So what then?
Hannah said nothing, her gaze fixed on the snow. She didn't want to talk. Or perhaps she felt she'd already said too much. Nina cut her a sidelong look.
I can tell you're eager for a last chance to ride before you go back.
Is it that obvious? I can see it in the way your eyes stray to the horizon. The way you hold the reins. Nina hesitated, then added,
The trick of acting is to believe the lie yourself, at least a little. Acting begins in the body. If you want to convince anyone of anything, you start with the way the body moves. It tells a thousand stories before you ever open your mouth.
And what stories am I telling?
Are you sure you want to know? It was one thing to see the truth of someone. It was another to speak it back to them.
Go on, said Hannah,
but her hands were tight on the reins.
You're strong, but you're afraid of anyone seeing it, so you hunch and try to make yourself smaller. You're only at ease when you think no one is watching, but then...
She reached out and tapped Hannah's thigh.
Then you're glorious.
Hannah shot her a wary glance.
I know what I look like.
Do you? Nina would have liked to tell Hannah that she could stroll into Osalta, all 6 feet of her, with her chestnut dipped in strawberry syrup hair and her copper coin eyes, and 1,000 Ravkin courtiers would write songs to her beauty. Nina might be the first, but that would lead to a few questions.
At least she could offer Hannah something. I won't tell anyone what you are.
Hannah's eyes turned hard.
Why? They'd reward you. Informing on Grisha carries a weight of silver. Why would you be that kind?
I'm not being kind. I'm earning your trust. But I won't sentence you to death if I can help it.
Because you dove in to save my life when you might have ridden by, Nina said, then took the leap. And because I don't believe that Grisha power makes you evil.
It's a sin, Hannah hissed. It's poison. If I could rid myself of it, I would.
I understand, said Nina,
though every part of her wanted to protest.
But you can't. So the question is whether you want to hate what you are and put yourself at greater risk of discovery, or accept this thing inside you and learn to control it.
Or abandon this saint's forsaken country altogether.
What if I only make it stronger?
I don't think it works that way, said Nina. But I know that if Grisha don't use their power, eventually they begin to sicken. Hannah swallowed.
I like using it. I hate myself every time, but I just want to do it again.
There are some, Nina said cautiously, who believe that such power is a gift from Jell, and not some kind of calamity.
Those are the whisperings of heretics and heathens.
When Nina didn't reply, Hannah said,
You never told me what happened to your sister.
She learned to contain her power and found happiness. She's married now and lives on the Ravkin border with her handsome husband.
Really?
No, not really. Any sister of mine would be a heartrender waging war on your ignorant, short-sighted government.
Yes, Nina lied. I remember a great deal from the lessons she received. There was some concern that I might have a latent corruption, and so I was taught alongside her. I may be able to help you learn to control your power, too.
Why would you take such a risk?
Because I intend to pump you for information while I do, and knock some sense into you at the same time. After all, Nina had managed to get through to one thick-headed Fjerdin. Maybe she'd prove to have a talent for it.
Because someone once did the same for my sister, she said. It's the least I can do.
but we'll need a pretext for spending time together at the convent. How do you feel about learning Zemini? My parents would prefer I continue to work on my Kirch. I don't know Kirch, Nina lied.
I don't wish to owe you a debt,
Hannah protested. She's afraid of her power, Nina thought. But I can take away that fear. We'll find a way for you to make it up to me, she said. Promise. Now, go. Get a last ride in before the next snow comes. Hannah looked startled, almost disbelieving. Then she dug her heels into her horse's flanks and took off at a hard gallop, body low, face turned to the wind. As if she and the animal were one, a hybrid creature born of the wild. How few people had been kind to Hannah that she would be so surprised by a small gesture of generosity. Except you're not being generous, Nina reminded herself as she nudged her own mount forward. You're not being kind. She was going to use Hannah. If she could help her in the process, so be it. But Nina's duty was to the lost girls on the mountain, the women in their graves. Justice. All Nina could do was throw this girl a rope. Hannah would have to be the one to seize it. An hour later, Nina and Adric entered the stables at the convent. They'd been gone one night, but to Nina it seemed as if a long season had passed. Her mind felt overburdened with emotion and new information. Matthias. Thrassel. Hannah. The women buried at the factory. The puncture marks throbbing on her forearm. She'd been attacked by wolves, for Saint's sake. She needed a hot bath, a plate of waffles, and about 12 hours of sleep. Leonie waved when she saw them. She was perched on a low stool in a shadowy corner of the stables, hidden from the curious eyes of passers-by, by a few of the crates Nina and Adric had left behind. She set up a small camp stove, and the space around her was littered with the pots and glass vials she must have been using to test the water samples.
I thought you'd be back sooner, she said with a smile.
Adric led his horse to a stall.
Nina decided to have an adventure.
A good one? Asked Leonie.
An informative one, said Nina.
How long have you been at this?
All night,
Leonie admitted. She didn't look well. Let's go to town for lunch, said Nina. I can't handle another meal of convent mush. Leonie stood, then braced her hand against the wall. Her eyes rolled back in her head and she swayed sharply.
Leonie!
Nina cried as she and Adric rushed to her side, just managing to reach her before she collapsed. They laid her gently back beside the camp stove. She was soaked in sweat and her skin felt like fire. Leonie's eyes fluttered open.
That was unexpected,
she said. And then she had the gall to smile.
This is no time to be in a good mood, said Adric. Your pulse is racing and you're burning up.
I'm not dead, though.
Stop looking on the bright side and tell me when this started.
I think I botched the testing, said Leonie,
her voice thready.
I was trying to pull the pollutants from the samples, isolate them. I may have absorbed some into my body. I told you, poisons are tricky work.
I'll take you back to the dormitories, said Nina. I can get clean water.
No, I don't want the spring maidens getting suspicious.
We can tend to her here, said Adric. Get her settled behind the sledge. I can make a fire and brew clean water for tea.
There's a tincture of charcoal in my kit, said Leonie. Add a few drops. It will absorb the toxins.
Nina arranged a bed of blankets for Leonie out of sight of the main courtyard and tried to make her comfortable there.
There's something else,
Leonie said as she lay back. Nina did not like the gray tinge to her skin or the way her eyelids fluttered.
Just rest. It can wait. The well mother came to me.
What happened?
Adric said, kneeling beside her with a steaming cup of tea.
Here, try to take a sip. Did one of the novitiates talk about seeing us in the woods?
No. One of them died.
Nina stilled. The girl who fell from her horse.
I didn't realize her injuries were so serious, said Adric.
They weren't, said Lanny, sipping slowly. I think it was the river. She was in the water for a while, and she had an open wound.
All saints, Adric said. What the hell are they doing up at that factory?
I don't know, but... Nina hesitated, then plowed ahead.
But there are graves all over that mountain. Behind the reservoir, all over the factory yards, I felt them everywhere.
What? Said Adric. Why didn't you tell us? How do you know?
Lainey's eyes had closed. Her speeding pulse seemed to have slowed a bit. A good sign.
Is there more clean water? Asked Nina.
We should try to ease the fever. And will you see if there's some carbolic in her kit?
Why?
Adric asked, as he fetched his canteen and the disinfectant.
Is she wounded?
No, I am. I got bitten by a wolf last night.
Of course you did.
Nina shrugged off her coat, revealing her torn and bloodied sleeve.
Wait, said Adric. You're serious?
He sat down beside Lanny and rubbed his temples with his fingers.
One soldier poisoned, another attacked by wolves. This mission is going swimmingly.
Nina pulled a length of cloth from the sledge and tore it in two. She used one half to make a compress for Lanny, and the other to clean and bind the wound on her arm.
Then that girl Hannah rescued you from a wolf attack?
Adric asked.
Something like that.
Nina wasn't ready to talk about Trassel. The last thing she needed was Adric's skepticism.
I think it's possible there was Perem in the bite.
What?
Nina glanced at Lanny, whose eyelids fluttered.
I can't be sure, but the wolves weren't behaving normally. It felt like Perem.
Then your addiction.
Nina shook her head.
I'm okay so far.
That wasn't entirely true. Even the suggestion of Perem was enough to make her feel the pull of that animal hunger. But the edge of need seemed duller than she would have expected.
Saints, said Adric, leaning forward. If it's in the water. And Leonie was dosed with it.
Leonie isn't acting like a Grisha exposed to Perem. She would be clawing at the walls, desperate for another dose. Nina knew that all too well. But her other symptoms are similar to exposure, and enough Perem could kill someone without Grisha powers. Like the novitiate.
It wasn't Perem,
Leonie mumbled.
I don't think.
I thought you were asleep.
I am,
said Leonie.
There's something corrosive in the water.
Can you drink some more tea?
Asked Adric. She nodded and managed to push up to her elbows.
I haven't isolated it yet. Why didn't you tell us about the graves when you found them, Nina?
You sure you don't want to go back to sleep? Nina asked, then sighed. She looked down at the folded compress in her hands.
I don't know why, I think.
They led me to the eastern entrance.
Who led you?
Nina cleared her throat and patted Leonie's brow gently with a cloth.
I heard the dead speak. I heard them all the way back in Elling.
Okay,
Leonie said cautiously.
What exactly did they say?
They need our help. My help.
The dead, repeated Adric. Need our help.
I realize I sound like I've gone loopy, but we need to get inside that factory. And I think I know someone who can help. Nina brought Leonie back to the dormitories before nightfall and got her tucked into bed. Her fever had broken, and she was already feeling better, further proof that whatever she'd found in the water was not Perem. So what was wrong with those wolves? And what had been in their bite? And what had killed the novitiate? She took a plate of kitchen scraps out to the woods and set them at the base of a tree in the silly hope that Trassel might find his way to her again. They'd probably be eaten by some ungrateful rodent. Standing at the edge of the forest, Nina looked up at the factory, its lights glowing gold in the gathering dust, the windows of the eastern wing dark.
She thought of the twisting roots of Jell's ash carved into the walls of the reservoir. There's poison in this place. She could almost taste it, bitter on her tongue. But just how deep does it go? The next morning, Nina was pleased to find a summons to the Well Mother's office had been slid beneath their door. Nina was to meet with her and Hana after morning prayers to discuss the possibility of language lessons. So Hana did want to learn more about her Grisha gifts, even if it was only to control them. Of course, Adric had been wary of her plan.
"We're better off using our time to gather intelligence here and in the neighboring towns," he complained. "Fierda is gearing up for something. With the right information, our forces may be able to waylay a wagon or shipment or shut this place down entirely. But not if the Fjerdans catch wind of our activities and move their operations. You don't know how easy it is to ruin your cover, Nina. This is a dangerous game."
Nina wanted to scream. She'd been a spy for Zoya Nazielenski on the Wandering Isle. She'd spent a year on her own in Ketterdam doing jobs for Kaz Brekker. She'd infiltrated the Ice Court as a girl from the menagerie. She might be new to this particular game, but she'd played for high stakes plenty of times. "I can manage this, Adric," she said as calmly as she could. "You know she's our best possible asset. We can find out what's happening in that factory. We don't need someone else to do it."
"What do we really know about this girl?"
"She's Grisha, and she's miserable. Aren't we here to save people exactly like her?"
"From what you've told me, she doesn't want rescue."
"Maybe I'll change her mind. And in the meantime, I can get access to the rest of the convent." Nina and Leonie were quartered in a room abutting the kitchens and locked off from the bulk of the building and the dormitories. The Spring Maidens are the only locals allowed into the factory. I may actually be able to figure out a way to get us inside.
"You'll take no action without my say-so," said Adric. "And first you have to get past the Well Mother."
Nina left Adric and Leonie in the stables and crossed the courtyard to the chapel, passing through the heavy door covered in its elaborate knots of ash bough. The sweet loamy scent of the timber walls enveloped her, and she took a moment to let her eyes adjust to the gloom. The air was cold and still, the pews lit by the glow of lanterns and weak sunlight from a few slender windows set high above the transept. There was no altar, no painted scene of saints. Instead, a massive tree sprawled across the apse of the chapel, its roots extending to the first rows of pews, Jell's ash, fed by the wellspring. "Whose prayers do you hear?" Nina wondered. "Do you hear the words of soldiers? A Fjerdan Grisha locked in Jarl Broom's cells?" The whispers in her head seemed to sigh. In regret? In longing? She didn't know. She smoothed her skirts and hurried down the side aisle to the Well Mother's office.
"Anke Janderstadt,"
the older woman said when Nina entered, addressing her by the title Widow.
"Hana tells me you're willing to offer lessons in Zemini. I hope you realize the convent cannot provide a tutor's fees."
Hana remained silent, dressed in her pale blue pinafore and tidy white blouse, eyes on her impractical felt slippers. Her ruddy brown hair had been neatly braided and twisted into a tight corona on her head. The uniform didn't suit her. Nina had the urge to seize the pins from Hana's braids and see all that glorious hair come down again.
"Of course," said Nina. "I would require no payment. All I ask is that you let us partake of your hospitality a bit longer, and if you have a copper cookpot, that my employers might have the loan of it."
Leonie felt sure she could continue her experiments safely now that she knew what she was dealing with. But copper instruments would be a help.
"It seems a too generous offer," said the Well Mother, her lips pressed into a suspicious line.
"You've caught me," said Nina, and saw Hana's eyes widen.
Saints, if Hana intended to continue living in this wretched country, she was going to need an education in deception. Maybe an internship in Ketterdam. Nina hadn't been caught at anything. but she could tell the well mother thought she had some kind of angle, so she intended to give her one. The truth is that I cannot continue my work as a guide much longer. The travel is a hardship. And at some point, I need to seek a more permanent position to provide for myself.
We do not hire outside of the order.
Oh, no, of course, I understand. But a reference from the well-mother of Gafala would mean so much to other Fjerdans seeking a teacher for their children. The well-mother preened, her chin lifting. Piety was little defense against flattery.
Well, I can see how that might be a boon. We shall see what good you can do with our Hana. It's a bit late for her to be taking up a new language, but to be frank, it's a relief to see her interested in anything that doesn't involve a muddy romp in the woods.
The well-mother escorted them to an empty classroom and told them they were free to work until lunchtime.
I expect you to keep up with your other work, Hana. Your father will not like it if you become a burden to this institution.
Yes, well, mother, she replied dutifully. But as the older woman departed, Hana cast a black look at the door and slumped into one of the desks.
She agreed to the lessons, said Nina. It could be worse.
She considers me one of her failures. Unmarried at 19, with no prospects and no signs of a true calling to Jell.
Are all of the Spring Maidens supposed to be called?
Nina asked, as she picked up a piece of chalk and began to conjugate a Zemini verb on the slate board that covered most of one wall.
I don't know. Some say they are, claim to have visions, but I'm not sure Jell is interested in girls like me.
Do you really mean to give up your life as a guide?
No, said Nina, trying to keep her chalk letter straight. I'm not ready to live in one place just yet.
Only when she said the words did she realize that might be true. She'd been restless in Ravka, and now she wondered if she might be restless anywhere she tried to settle. Nina took a sheaf of papers from her pocket.
These are rudimentary Zemini lessons. You'll need to copy them into your notebook so it looks like we're actually doing some work.
You mean I'm really going to have to learn Zemini?
A little. You don't have to be good at it. She gestured to the board.
We'll start with this verb, bes adawa. She raised her hands and planted her legs in the first stance each Grisha was taught.
To fight.
The lesson lasted 2 hours. Nina started just as her own education had begun at the little palace, by teaching Hana to use her heartrender power on herself.
Have you ever tried it? Nina asked.
No. I'm not sure. Sometimes when I can't sleep, I'll think of my heart slowing.
Nina winced. You're lucky you didn't put yourself into a coma.
Nina talked her through rudimentary breathing techniques and basic fighting stances. She had Hana slow her own heart, then make it race. She touched only briefly on Grisha theory and how amplifiers worked, and she steered well clear of any talk of Jurdaparem.
How do you know all of this? Hana said.
Her cheeks were flushed from using her power, and her hair had escaped her braids to curl at her temples.
You really learned everything from your sister's teacher?
Nina turned her back to erase the board and hide her expression. It was possible she'd gotten carried away.
You don't know how easy it is to ruin your cover, Nina.
She could just imagine Adric sing-song, "What did I tell you?"
Yes, she said. I paid close attention. But you're also a natural. You're picking up on the work very quickly.
That at least was true. Hana had an ease with her power that was something special. But her face was troubled.
What is it? Nina asked. That word. Natural.
Hana ran her finger over one of the sheets where she'd scrawled the conjugation of another Zemini verb. Her penmanship was tragic.
When I was younger, my father took me everywhere, to ride, to hunt. It was unorthodox, but he longed for a son, and I think he believed there was no harm in it. I loved it. Fighting, horsemanship, running free. But when I got older, and it was time to present me at court, I couldn't shake it off. And why should you have to? Nina thought. She didn't have any great love for horses and preferred not to run anywhere, unless being chased. But at least she was allowed those opportunities. Hannah folded her arms, her shoulders hunching, looking like she wanted to crumple into herself.
Unnatural, they called me. A woman's body is meant to be soft, but mine was hard. A lady is meant to take small, graceful steps, but I strode. I was a laughingstock.
Hannah gazed up at the ceiling.
My father blamed himself for corrupting me. I couldn't sing or paint, but I could clean a deer and string a bow. I could build a shelter. All I wanted was to escape to the woods, sleep beneath the stars.
That sounds horrible, admitted Nina. But I think I can understand the appeal.
I tried to change, I really did,
Hannah shrugged.
I failed. If I fail again?
Her gaze was bleak, and Nina wondered what grim future she was seeing. What happens if you fail again?
The school was supposed to make me presentable. Good marriage material. If the well mother can't fix me, I'll never be allowed to go home. Never be presented at court. It should have happened 2 years ago.
Would it be so bad not to go back?
And never see my parents, live like an exile?
Are those the choices? I find a way to fit in or I take vows and live the rest of my life out here, in service to Jell, among women of the well. She scowled.
I wish I was an Inferni instead of a Heartrender.
That's ridiculous, Nina said without thinking, her pride bristling.
How could anyone want to be a summoner instead of a Corporalkai? Everyone knows we're the best order.
I mean, why would anyone want to be an Inferni? Hannah's bright eyes flashed as if in challenge.
So I could melt the ice court from the inside out, wash the whole big mess into the sea.
Dangerous words. And maybe Nina should have pretended to be scandalized. Instead, she grinned. The grandest puddle in the world.
Exactly, said Hannah,
returning her smile, that wicked edge curling her lips. Suddenly, Nina wanted to tell Hannah all of it. My friends and I blew a hole in the ice court wall. We stole a Fjerdan tank. All saints, did she want to brag? Nina gave her head a shake.
This is a chance to gain her confidence, she told herself. Take it.
She sat down at the desk next to Hannah's and said,
If you could go anywhere, do anything, what would you choose for yourself?
Navizem,
Hannah said instantly. I'd get a job, make my own money, hire myself out as a sharpshooter.
You're that good?
I am, Hannah said without a hint of hesitation. I think about it every time I ride out, just disappearing, making everyone believe I was lost in a storm or that I was carried away by the river.
Beastly idea. Come to Ravka. Then why not do it? Why not just go? Hannah stared at her, shocked.
I couldn't do that to my parents. I couldn't shame them that way.
Nina narrowly avoided rolling her eyes.
Fjerdans and their honor.
Of course not, she said swiftly. But she couldn't help but think of Hannah riding into the clearing, rifle raised, braids loose, a warrior born. There was gold in her. Nina could see it, the shine dimmed by years of being told there was something wrong with the way she was made. Those glimpses of the real Hannah, the Hannah who was meant to be, were driving her to distraction.
You're not here to make a new friend, Zenik, she chastised herself. You're here for information.
What if the well mother casts you out? She asked.
She won't. My father is a generous donor.
And if she catches you flouncing about in men's trousers? Nina prodded.
She won't.
If my friends and I had been less generous, she might have. Now Hannah leaned back and grinned with easy confidence.
There you are, thought Nina. It would have been your word against mine. I would have been dressed neatly in my pinafore and back behind the convent walls before you'd knocked on the well mother's door.
Interesting. Nina put all the condescension she could summon in her tone and said,
Of course you would have.
Hannah sat up straighter and jabbed her finger into the surface of the desk.
I know every step that creaks in this place. I know just where the cook stashes the key to the west kitchen door, and I have pinafores and changes of clothes stowed everywhere from the chapel to the roof. I don't get caught.
Nina held up her hands to make peace.
I just think you might consider more caution. Says the girl teaching me Grisha skills in the halls of Jill.
Maybe I have less to lose than you do. Hannah raised a brow.
Or maybe you just think you're better at being bold.
Try me, thought Nina. But all she said was, back to work. Let's see if you can make my heart race. Chapter 14. Zoya. Zoya had spent little time in Krybirsk since the war. There wasn't much cause, and it held too many bad memories. In the days when Ravka had been split from its western coastline by the Shadowfold, Krybirsk had served as the last place of safety, a town where merchants and bold travelers outfitted their journeys, and where soldiers might spend a final night drinking away their terror, or paying for comfort in a lover's arms before they boarded a sandskiff and were launched into the unnatural darkness of the fold. Many never returned. Krybirsk had been a port, but now the dark territory known as the Unsea was gone, and Krybirsk was just another small town with little to offer but a sad history. Vestiges of the town's former glory remained, the jail and barracks, the building that had once housed officers of the First Army, and where the Triumvirate had first met with Ravka's new king. But the sprawling encampment of tents and horses and soldiers was no more. It was said you could still find unspent bullets in the dust, and occasionally scraps of silk from the black pavilion where the Darkling had once held court. Though the darkness of the fold and the monsters that populated it were gone, the sands were not, and the shifting ground could be tricky for wagons to navigate. Merchants traversing Ravka still came to the dry docks to book passage on sandskiffs. But now guards were hired to protect cargo from marauders and thieves, not from the threat of flesh-eating Volkra that had once terrorized travelers. The monsters had vanished, and all that remained was a long, barren stretch of gray sand, eerie in its emptiness. Nothing could grow in the lifeless terrain that the Darkling's power had left behind. The businesses of Krybirsk were the same as they'd always been. Inns, brothels, outfitters. There were just fewer of them. Only the church had changed. The simple whitewashed building with its blue dome had once been dedicated to Sankt Vladimir. Now a blazing golden sun hung over the entry, a sign that the building had been reconsecrated to Sancta Alina of the Fold. It had taken a long time for Zoya to think of Alina as anything other than a rival. She'd resented the orphan girl's gifts, envied her position with the Darkling. She hadn't understood what power meant then or the price that any of them would be forced to pay for it. After the war, Alina had chosen a life of peace and anonymity, bought with the charade of her death. But her name and her legend had only grown. Zoya was surprised to find she liked seeing Alina's name on the churches, liked hearing it spoken in prayers. Ravka had given too much of its love to men like the Darkling, the Apparat, even the Lansov kings. They owed a little of it to an orphan girl with no dress sense. Though the symbol crowning the church's entry had changed, its outer walls remained the same. They were covered in the names of the dead, victims of the Darkling slaughter of Novokrybirsk, Krybirsk's sister city, the town that had once lain almost directly across the Shadowfold. Sun and time had faded the painted script so that it would be nearly illegible to anyone who did not hold the names of the lost in their hearts.
One day those words will fade to nothing, Zoya thought.
The people who mourn the dead would be gone too.
I'll be gone. Who will remember them then?
Zoya knew that if she walked to the southwest corner, she would find the names of Liliana Garin and her ward. But she would not make that walk. Would not trace those clumsy letters with her fingertips. After all this time, she still had not found an end to her grief. It was a dark well,
an echoing place into which she'd once cast a stone, sure that it would strike bottom and she would stop hurting. Instead, it just kept falling. She forgot about the stone, forgot about the well, sometimes for days or even weeks at a time. Then she would think Liliana's name, or her eye would pause on the little boat painted on her bedroom wall, its two-starred flag frozen in the wind. She'd sit down to write a letter and realize she had no one to write to, and the quiet that surrounded her became the silence of the well, of the stone still falling. No, she would not turn that corner of the church. She would not touch her fingers to those names. Not today. Zoya nudged her horse's flanks with her heels and turned her mount back toward town. Zoya, Tamar, and Nikolai took up residence in a boarding house inauspiciously named The Wreck, which had been built to look like a large ship run aground. Zoya remembered it bustling with soldiers and merchants in its heyday, and the terrible accordion player who had played from morning until night on the stoop to lure travelers from the road. At least he was long gone. Tolia was billeted across the street with the monk. Together, the twins were too noticeable, and this particular stop on the royal itinerary was being kept a secret. They'd sent the great golden coach and its glittering outriders to Karemzin. There, the party would be welcomed by the couple who ran the orphanage, and who they knew could be trusted with the secrets of the crown. Zoya found her bath lukewarm, and the meal of squirrel and stewed turnip unappetizing, but she was too tired to complain. She slept and dreamed of monsters. In the morning, she woke Nikolai with the red bottle of stimulant, and they settled in his sitting room to tackle the business of the day. Later they might find an ancient thornwood buried in the sands, but Ravka required constant attention, and this morning that meant matters of state could not wait. Zoya spent a few hours going over her correspondence. She sent Jenya and David a coded missive with the essentials of the Kergut attack, and instructions to double the sorties patrolling the skies around Os Alta. The capital was exposed, and she hated to think what might happen if the Kergut attacked the Grisha school. Any assault on the little palace would be considered an overt act of war, and she doubted the Shu would dare it. But Zoya didn't intend to take chances. She sent similar missives to Grisha stationed throughout Ravka, with instructions to be vigilant night and day, and requests that their first army liaisons post additional soldiers in towers and high lookouts. It would have been more expedient to have the Grisha at the outposts make the requests directly, but protocol was protocol. Some part of her would always resent this dance, but these gestures existed to preserve the dignity of the people involved. The Grisha did not want to be vulnerable, and the First Army wanted to maintain their authority. Once Nikolai had breakfasted, they worked side by side, largely in silence, only occasionally consulting each other. One of Tamar's sources claims there are rumors a member of the Shu Royal Guard wants to defect, said Zoya, reading through the file Tamar had left her.
A member of the Tavgarad? That would be quite the coup. Zoya nodded.
The party will be the perfect opportunity to make contact.
Are you saying my festival of autumn nonsense was a brilliant idea after all?
I said no such thing, but we'll make sure you have plenty of time to flirt with a Shu princess and that Tolia and Tamar have a chance to interact with the royal guard.
For the prospect of that kind of intelligence, I can certainly develop a passion for the playing of the katur.
What if it's only 12 strings and not 18?
I'll endeavor to hide my disdain.
Zoya set the file aside and said, Would you have Pensky requisition more soldiers at Arkesk for lookouts?
He was the First Army general Zoya dealt with most.
I think they could be particularly open to Kergut attack.
Why don't you write him yourself?
Because I've sent him 2 troop requests in the last month. So it would be better if this ask came from you.
Nikolai grunted, a pen between his teeth, then yanked it free and said,
I'll write to Pensky. But does that mean we should reassign the Grisha near Holmhead? And can you requisition me a napkin? I've spilled tea all over this note to the Kalish ambassador.
Zoya sent two napkins fluttering over the side table and dropped them into a pile beside Nikolai's elbow. She was grateful for the quiet this morning, the easy return to routine. There were times like this, when they worked side by side, when the rhythm between them was so easy that her mind would turn traitor. She would look at the tousle of Nikolai's gilded head bent over some correspondence, or his long fingers tearing into a roll, and she would wonder what it would be like when he finally married, when he belonged to someone else. And she lost these moments of peace. Zoya would still be Nikolai's general, but she knew it would be different. He would have someone else to tease and lean on and argue over the herring with. She'd made men fall in love with her before, when she was young and cruel and liked to test her power. Zoya did not desire. She was desired. And that was the way she liked it. It was galling to admit that she wasn't at all sure she could make Nikolai want her, and more galling to think that part of her longed to try. To know he was as impervious to her beauty as he seemed. To know if someone like him, full of hope and light and optimistic endeavor, could love someone like her. But even when her mind played these unkind games, Zoya knew better than to let them go too far. Her careful dealings with the First Army, her monitoring of Grisha matters all over Ravka, made it perfectly clear that, even if Nikolai had seen her as something more than an able commander, Ravka would never accept a Grisha queen. Alina had been different, a saint, treasured by the people, a symbol of hope for the future, but to Ravka's common folk, Zoya would always be the raven-haired witch who ruled the storms. Dangerous. Untrustworthy. They would never give up their precious golden son to a girl born of lightning and thunder and common blood. And I wouldn't have it any other way. A crown was well and good, and sentiment made for moving melodramas, but Zoya had learned the power of fear long ago. A sharp rap at the door drew Zoya from her reverie, and she found Tamar and Tolya in the hall, their uniforms concealed beneath heavy nondescript coats, bracketing Yuri, his earnest face half hidden by a scarf. They would all travel to the fold in disguise, high-collared coats and cloaks of peasant rough-spun. "Why can't we ever go undercover as wealthy people?" Zoya complained, taking the hideous cloak Tamar had brought her and fastening it over her kefta. "A silk merchant and his glamorous model?" Nikolai asked. "Yes, I'll even play the merchant. You can be my handsome muse." "Zoya, did you just call me handsome?" "All part of the act, Your Highness." He clutched his heart in mock despair and turned to the others. "We'll take our first trip slowly. Do we know exactly where we're going? The fold doesn't have many landmarks." "The followers of the Starless Saint will be waiting," said the monk, practically dancing. "They know where he fell. They'll remember." "Do they?" Zoya retorted. "I don't recall any of them being there." "If they had been, they would remember all the names of the dead, not just your precious darkling." "I was at the dry docks earlier," said Tamar quickly. "There's talk of a new encampment about 10 miles due west." "I told you," said Yuri. Nikolai must have sensed Zoya's desire to snap every bone in the monk's body, because he stepped between them and said, "Then that's where we'll start. Yuri, you will remain with us, and you will not interact with the pilgrims." "But I do not want you recognized." "I don't want any of us recognized. Keep in mind what's at stake here." He placed a hand on Yuri's shoulder and shamelessly added, "The very soul of a nation." At least if Zoya vomited, it would be on this awful cloak. A skiff had been readied for them at the dry docks, a wide, flat craft on chubby sled rails designed to bear the weight of cargo over the sands. These old vehicles were built for silence, since sound had risked drawing the attention of the Volcra, and constructed cheaply, since they were so frequently destroyed. The skiff was little more than a platform with a sail. Two junior squalors stood at the ready by the mast, looking eager and ludicrously young in their blue kefta. It was an easy assignment for students preparing to graduate, far from the fighting but where they could practice their languages and get the feel of following commands. Tolya stood at the prow. At the stern, Zoya and Yuri flanked Nikolai. Tamar stood guard at the monk's other side, in case he was compelled to try to commune with his fellow zealots. Zoya kept her shawl up, but watched the squallers closely as they lifted their arms and summoned air currents to fill the sails. It was hard not to think of her early days in the Second Army.